final case this morning is United States against Pittman. Mr. Handelsman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Handelsman for the appellant. I'll rest on the briefs for argument one. Before we get to the issue of structural prejudice.
What is argument one?
It was a weight of the evidence, sufficiency of the evidence on the search. Mm-hmm. I'll rest on the briefs for that. Before we get to the issue of structural, prejudicial, and harmless error, government raises three points I'd like to briefly address. The first one is that the offered jury instruction referred to the wrong subjects. We would submit to you that this was a practice of law by ambush. The AUSA didn't object to the instruction because it referred to the wrong subjects. If he did, it could have been corrected. Closing was after the instruction conference. The instruction was offered, referred to mistake and accident, and the government says, well, we used the evidence for intent and knowledge. Instruction wasn't sufficient. There was no objection to the instruction on that basis. The second issue the government raises is that the argument in the initial brief about using this evidence in closing of plain error was too attenuated to be decided. The contention in the briefs about plain error in the closing is part and parcel of the argument that the instruction should have been given. If the instruction should have been given, that closing argument was plain error. The third issue is a supposed general reference to the evidence in closing. There is no exception in Rule 105 or Huddleston versus United States for a general reference. The AUSA specifically used this evidence to argue Pittman knew what he was doing. Now, on the issue of structural versus plain ordinary prejudicial error, I first submit that this evidence was structural because it allowed Pittman to be convicted on evidence of propensity, which page 25 of the initial brief calls the antithesis of what we can expect from a trial in American court. On the issue of prejudicial, what sets this case apart from probably all the other harmless versus prejudicial cases you see is that this was the second jury to hear this case. The first jury obviously found a problem with the government's evidence because it couldn't reach a verdict. Therefore, the evidence cannot be called overwhelming. Now, the key point we want to emphasize here on the issue of prejudicial error raised in the reply brief, there is much more 404B evidence in the second trial than there was at the first. Basically, at the first, there was next to nothing. The only evidence was that Pittman bought the crack from someone else. And, you know, obviously he didn't go down to Columbia to get it, so he had to buy it from someone else. But I think there was three pages of the officer's testimony of Pittman's admissions of his prior dealings and the witness Schoenweiss testified to other dealings. There was no instruction limiting the jury as to what that evidence was admitted for. The jury may very well have used it as evidence of propensity. That's why Pittman was convicted, and that's why you must reverse. I'd submit as a matter of ordinary practice, when there's 404B evidence used in a case, and a defense lawyer walks in and asks for an instruction, the standard cautionary instruction, it's mandatory that it be given. And in this case, we cannot say that the evidence was so overwhelming, particularly in light of the hung jury in the first trial, that this is harmless error. Either structural or prejudicial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Clark.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Clark, and I represent the United States in this matter. With respect to the first issue regarding the traffic stop, that issue is clearly a credibility matter for the court, and absent clear error, the decision should be affirmed. Both officers testified that They initially saw the car only from the rear and consequently didn't see the temporary tags. The argument in the brief was, in the appellant's brief, was that there was a police report that indicated that the dispatcher had dispatched the second officer to follow Pittman's car, which had applied for plates. However, the testimony of both officers at the suppression hearing was clear that neither one of them saw the temporary tag until the point where the car, where Officer Young had approached the car to investigate the matter further. With respect to the second issue on the jury instructions, I would like to take a different tack from that which I took in the brief and concede that it was error for the court not to give the 404B instruction. However, the error was harmless.
When you say the 404B instruction, you mean the one tendered by the defense?
Correct.
Although the one tendered by the defense seems to be legally inaccurate.
The one tendered by the
defense? One tendered by the defense said this evidence may be used only for, and then it named two specific purposes.
Correct.
And that's not the list that's in the rule.
That's
and
correct.
And so it's legally wrong. Why would district judges be obliged to give legally incorrect instructions?
Well, Your Honor, it may be, the instruction may be, or rather the evidence may be introduced for any one of those purposes. It doesn't have to satisfy all of those purposes. And therefore, you know, if the government had introduced the evidence.
You're confessing error here on a legally insufficient instruction? I'm having a problem.
Well, given the statement from or the observations by the court, perhaps I should withdraw the confession of error, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is that the defendant did offer it for those two limited purposes. The government then did, in its closing argument, the prosecutor did state that the evidence was offered to show intent. As a matter of fact, the court did give the defense the opportunity to seek further instructions after the closing argument. The judge did give the defense the opportunity to provide further instruction. However, none was tendered. He could have done so in regard to the fact that the prosecution did offer the evidence to show intent. However, he did not make any further objection. He did not offer further instruction. even if it was error to refuse the instruction, it had to be harmless error because the other evidence in the case was overwhelming. Schoenweiss testified, unlike in the first trial, Schoenweiss testified that she had in fact obtained the drugs from Pittman daily for 5 months prior to the incident for which he was charged. Furthermore, the defendant confessed to Agent Watson that he had distributed the crack cocaine to Schoenweiss on June 20th.
Did you say in the first trial? Did I hear you say that?
Yes, sir.
What did that guy do? That's the one that was...
No, I said unlike the first trial.
Oh, Schoenweiss. I'm sorry. I misunderstood you. You said unlike the first trial. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Which goes to appellant's point. Schoenweiss, it's my recollection that Schoenweiss did not testify in that first trial, and that fact alone could have been the reason for the guilty verdict in the second trial. Furthermore, there were the police observations on the parking lot on the June 20th date. The police knew from prior experience that Schoenweiss had been distributing to, I'm sorry, that had been receiving drugs from the defendant, Also, Officer Young observed some strange movements by Schoenweiss, which suggested to her that perhaps there may have been some drug activity going on, and ultimately the drugs were found concealed within Schoenweiss's body. So the evidence, in fact, here was substantial, even without the, even if the instruction had been given, the evidence here strongly points to the guilt of the defendant. This was certainly not a structural error, which really is limited to very few types of error that go to the foundation of a fair trial, and we don't have that situation here. Instead, we have harmless error, and the error must be deemed harmless if it is clear beyond reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. Consequently, we would ask that the decision below be affirmed.
Was this instruction only in the second trial, or was the same one used in the first trial?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Okay.
I was not the trial counsel.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Hamilton?
Yes, sir.
As I recall, the instructions in the appendix to the brief, I believe it was a pattern instruction where the proponent fills in the blanks about the...
It certainly wasn't the pattern instruction, because it had an inaccurate list of what things you could use such evidence for.
Well, Rule 404B says, I'm looking at it right now, absence of mistake or accident. That's what he put in there. And then there was no objection at trial. There was no objection in a conference saying, Judge, we're not using the evidence for absence of mistake or accident. We're using it for intent and knowledge. And the judge didn't refuse the instruction because he used the wrong words. He refused it because he didn't think any instruction was called for. If this, I don't have the pattern instruction in front of me, but if this instruction, as I recall, it followed it almost practically verbatim. Pattern instruction has some blanks. Just take the words out of 404B and put them in the blanks. Counsel put the wrong words in there. He didn't know how the government was going to use this evidence. There is no objection to allow him to correct it, and the prosecutor just told you, said, well, the judge asked for any corrections afterwards. The judge refused the instruction. He would have refused it if it said intent and knowledge. The judge refused the instruction because he didn't think it was 404B evidence, because it was an admission. It came out of Pittman's mouth rather than usual case from an officer or a co-defendant. There was nothing wrong with that instruction when it was tendered. And objection should have been made at that time that used the wrong words. Just like with pleading defects in a civil case, someone can't let them go by and come up here and argue them when there's a chance for them to be corrected at a proper place. As far as the evidence is concerned, if the evidence was overwhelming, the first jury would have convicted.
Well, wait a minute. She didn't testify according to him in the first...
She testified in the first jury. It's in a footnote in a reply brief, the pages where she testified, and you should get the transcript. So the way I found out is I asked for the transcripts to come up for the reply brief. They sent me the transcripts for the wrong trial. But she did testify at the first trial. February 19th, 02, pages 48 to 94. Schoenweiss testified.
I guess I'll ask the same question. Do you know if the instruction was used in the first trial as well as the second?
I don't recall, and I would tend to doubt it because there was almost no 404B evidence at the first trial. There was no evidence to his sales to other people in the first trial.
She testified differently in the first trial and the second trial?
I didn't compare it line by line. I looked to see where she testified to sales to other people. She did not testify to sales to other people in the first trial. She did at the second trial.
Well, there's that's the difference. So you think that's why it may not have been used in the first trial, and that issue would have already been exposed, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say exposed. It was moot in the first trial. If there's no 404B evidence to speak of, there's no need to offer the instruction in the first trial. The only testimony of other dealings, as I mentioned when I stood up here before, was that Pittman testified where he was buying the cracker to powder, which, you know, he had to get it from someplace. But it's his testimony of the other sale. And if you look at the volume in the second trial, it's much greater. This instruction here, substantively, was no different than the pattern instruction. He just put the wrong words in the blanks, and that shouldn't be a basis for affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you,
Thank you very much, Mr. Handelsman. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance both to your client and to us. And the case is taken under advisement.